57 members sit on the House Judiciary Committee, 21 Republicans and 16 Democrats. But when they spoke today, most began by invoking a nonpartisan tone, using words such as historic, monumental, and humility. Many referred to their constitutional duty, and a number of members said pursuing possible impeachment of the president was the most important responsibility of their elected careers, but not one they at all relished. Some members repeated statements they had made over the last 4 weeks. For others, it was the first major public statement on impeachment. Almost all read prepared remarks, choosing their words carefully, beginning with Committee Chairman Henry Hyde.
We are constantly reminded how weary America is of this whole situation, and I dare say most of us share that weariness. But we members of Congress took an oath that we would perform all of our constitutional duties, not just the pleasant ones. As Chairman Peter Rodino stated in 1974, quote, "We cannot turn away, out of partisanship or convenience, from problems that are now our responsibility, our inescapable responsibility to consider. It would be a violation of our own public trust if we, as the people's representatives, chose not to inquire, not to consult, not even to deliberate, and then pretend that we had not by default made choices," close quote. This will be an emotional process, a strenuous process, because feelings are high on all sides of this question. But the difficulties ahead can be surmounted with goodwill and an honest effort to do what is best for the country.
Chairman Hyde chose not to speak of evidence of possible impeachable offenses committed by the president. However, John Conyers, the committee's top Democrat, approached the issue head on.
Now, there's no question that the president's actions were wrong. I submit to all of you that he may be suffering more than any of us will ever know, but I suggest to you, my colleagues across the aisle, in every ounce of friendship that I can muster, that even worse than an extramarital relationship is the use of federal prosecutors and federal agents to expose an extramarital relationship. Yes, there is a threat to society here, but it is from the tactics of win-at-all-costs prosecutor determined to sink a president of the opposition party. Our review of the evidence sent with the referral convinces many of us of one thing. There is no support for any suggestion that the president obstructed justice or that he tampered with witnesses or abused the power of his office. By alleging abuses of power by the president, the independent counsel has simply repackaged his basic allegation of lying about sex in a quite transparent effort to conjure the ghost of Watergate.
Each member was allotted 5 minutes for an opening statement. Most used the time to stress a specific point, and for many of the Republicans, the point was that the president committed perjury.
It is important at the outset to note that this debate is not about the fact that President Clinton had an affair with Monica Lewinsky and then lied about it to his family, his staff, his cabinet, and to the American public. It is about Judge Starr's finding that the president violated his oath to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, in a successful attempt to defeat Paula Jones's civil rights suit against him.
When people believe that the President of the United States can lie, commit perjury, and get away with it, what are they going to say the next time they have to go to court? And thousands of them do every day in this country, and they're expected to tell the truth when they get on the witness stand or face the crime of perjury. I would suggest to you that it should be noted that today in our federal system there are 115 people serving time in federal prison at this present moment for perjury before a grand jury or a federal court. 115 people. I don't know if the president committed these crimes of perjury, but if he did, they alone, it seems to me, would merit impeachment and removal from office.
One point stressed by Democrats was to criticize the Republicans' desire to make the impeachment inquiry open-ended, unlimited both in time and scope.
There is a fear on the part of many who want to destroy Bill Clinton, who didn't like the 92 election, didn't like the 96 election, and would like to undo it. There is a fear that the matters in the Starr referral do not carry enough weight to justify an impeachment. The chairman himself, in a very fair way, yesterday, apparently on television, said that he did not think there were now votes in the Senate for impeachment, and that wouldn't be the case unless public opinion moved. What we have to resist, and I do not impute this to the chairman, but there are other people who I think have this motive, what we have to resist is an effort to keep going to try and move public opinion.
I'd support a motion of censure or a motion to rebuke, as President Ford suggested yesterday, not because it is politically expedient to do, but because the president's actions cry out for punishment, and because censure or rebuke, not impeachment, is the right punishment. It is time to move forward and not have the Congress and the American people endure a specter of what could be a year-long focus on a tawdry but not impeachable affair.
While some members indicated they had made up their minds as to whether the president had committed impeachable offenses, others said they would wait until they heard more evidence.
This is not just about sex, but it is colored by sex. That coloration could be viewed by some as irrelevant. That coloration could be viewed by some as mitigating criminal wrongdoing. It is up to this committee to decide, in this uniquely political and legal and democratic forum, the significance of the context and how, if at all, it affects our determination of whether impeachable offenses have been committed.
Nobody can tell me yet whether this is part of a criminal enterprise or a bunch of lies that build upon themselves based on not wanting embarrassing your family. If that's what it is, about an extramarital affair with an intern, and that's it, I will not vote to impeach this president, no matter if 82% of the people home want me to, because we will destroy this country. If it is about a criminal enterprise where the operatives of the president at every turn confront witnesses against him in illegal ways, threaten people, extort them, if there's a secret police unit in this White House that goes after women or anybody else that gets in the way of this president, that is Richard Nixon times 10, and I will vote to impeach him.
Opening statements alone took up all of 3 hours. Following a short break for lunch, the committee heard from its two chief investigators who have analyzed the information sent to the House by independent counsel Kenneth Starr. The Republicans' lead counsel, David Shippers, presented his findings first.
It has been the considered judgment of my staff and myself that our main focus should be on those alleged acts and omissions by the president which affect the rule of law and the structure and integrity of our court system. Deplorable as the numerous sexual encounters related in the evidence may be, we chose to emphasize the consequences of those acts as they affect the administration of justice and the unique role the president occupies in carrying out his oath faithfully to execute the laws of the nation. The prurient aspect of the referral is, at best, merely peripheral to the central issues. The assertions of presidential misconduct cited in the referral, though arising initially out of sexual indiscretions, are completely distinct and involve allegations of an ongoing series of deliberate and direct assaults by Mr. Clinton upon the justice system of the United States and upon the judicial branch of our government, which holds a place in the constitutional framework of checks and balances equal to that of the executive and the legislative branches. As a result of our research and review of the referral and supporting documentation, we respectfully submit that there exists substantial and credible evidence of 15 separate events directly involving President William Jefferson Clinton that could constitute felonies, which in turn may constitute grounds to proceed with an impeachment inquiry.
For an hour, Shippers methodically went through the allegations against the president and the evidence supporting them. For instance, he produced a series of charts showing a flurry of phone calls that followed the president's deposition in the Paula Jones sexual harassment case last January.
At approximately 1 p.m., the president calls both Vernon Jordan and Betty Curry at their homes. Between 2:15 and 2:55, the records show that Vernon Jordan placed one call to the White House and one call to the president himself, And at 5 o'clock, the president meets with Betty Curry. In that meeting, the president informs Ms. Curry that he had been questioned at his deposition about Monica Lewinsky. During the next 3 hours and 16 minutes, Betty Curry places 4 pages to Monica Lewinsky's pager, requesting that Monica call Kay, a previously agreed upon code name that was being used by Ms. Curry and Ms. Lewinsky. At 10:09 p.m., Monica Lewinsky finally telephoned Betty Curry at home. She told Betty Curry that she was not in a position to be able to talk, but that she would call back later.
Schiffer's briefing was carefully constructed, broken down into sections and subsections so that members could follow easily. This was Schiffer's explanation of the allegation that the president may have obstructed justice.
First, there is substantial and credible evidence that the president may have been part of a conspiracy with Monica Lewinsky and others to obstruct justice and the due administration of justice by A, providing false and misleading testimony under oath in a civil deposition and before the grand jury, B, withholding evidence and causing evidence to be withheld and concealed, and C, tampering with prospective witnesses in a civil lawsuit and before a federal grand jury. The president and Ms. Lewinsky had developed a cover story to conceal their activities. On December 6, 1997, the president learned that Ms. Lewinsky's name had appeared on the Jones versus Clinton witness list. He informed Ms. Lewinsky of that fact on December 17, 1997, and the two agreed that they would employ the same cover story in the Jones case. The president at that time suggested that an affidavit might be enough to prevent Ms. Lewinsky from testifying. On December 19, 1997, Ms. Lewinsky was subpoenaed to give a deposition in the Jones case. Thereafter, the record tends to establish that the following events took place. One, in the second week of December 1997, Ms. Lewinsky told Ms. Tripp that she would lie if called to testify and tried to convince Ms. Tripp to do the same. Two, Ms. Lewinsky attempted on several occasions to get Ms. Tripp to contact the White House before giving testimony in the Jones case. Three, Ms. Lewinsky participated in preparing a false and intentionally misleading affidavit to be filed in the Jones case. Four, Ms. Lewinsky provided a copy of the draft affidavit to a third party for approval and discussed changes calculated to mislead. Five, Ms. Lewinsky and the president talked by phone on January 6, 1998, and agreed that she would give false and misleading answers to questions about her job at the Pentagon. Six, on January 7, 1998, Ms. Lewinsky signed the false and misleading affidavit. The conspirators intended to use the affidavit to avoid Ms. Lewinsky's giving testimony. Seven, after Ms. Lewinsky's name surfaced, the conspirators began to employ code names in their contacts. Eight, on December 28, 1997, Ms. Lewinsky and the president met at the White House and discussed the subpoena she had received. Ms. Lewinsky suggested that she conceal the gifts that she'd received from the president. Shortly thereafter, the president's personal secretary, Betty Curry, picked up a box of the gifts from Ms. Lewinsky. 10, Betty Curry hid that box of gifts under her bed at home. 11, the president gave false and evasive answers to questions contained in interrogatories in the Jones case. 12, on December 31, 1997, Ms. Lewinsky, at the suggestion of a third party, deleted 50 draft notes that she'd made up to the president. She had already been subpoenaed to testify in the Jones case. 13, on January 17, 1998, the president's attorney produced Ms. Lewinsky's false affidavit at the president's deposition, and the president adopted it as true. 14, on January 17, 1998, in his deposition, the president gave false and misleading testimony under oath concerning his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky about the gifts she had given him and several other matters. 15, The president on January 18, 1998 and thereafter coached his personal secretary, Betty Curry, to give a false and misleading account of the Lewinsky relationship if called to testify. 16, the president narrated elaborate, detailed false accounts of his relationship with Monica Lewinsky to prospective witnesses with the intention that those false accounts would be repeated in testimony. 17, on August 17, 1998, the president gave false and misleading testimony under oath to a federal grand jury on the following points: his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky, his testimony in the January 17, 1998 deposition, his conversations with various individuals, and his knowledge of Ms. Lewinsky's affidavit and its falsity.
After detailing the evidence supporting all 15 of his charges against the president, Shippers concluded with a brief personal statement. He said it was delivered not as counsel to the committee, but as a father, grandfather, and citizen.
To paraphrase St. Thomas More in Robert Bolt's excellent play, A Man for All Seasons, the laws of this country are the great barriers that protect the citizens from the winds of evil and tyranny. If we permit one of those laws to fall, who will be able to stand in the winds that follow? 15 generations of Americans, our fellow Americans, many of whom are reposing in military cemeteries throughout the world, are looking down on and judging what you do today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Several Democrats quietly took exception to Shipper's personal statement, as did the Republican chairman, Henry Hyde.
The chair, in response to some questions and complaints by the Democrats, and I must say, I find them with some substance to them, object to Mr. Shipper's remarks as a citizen. He was here testifying as special counsel to the majority and not as a citizen. So those remarks he made at the end, which do not refer to the record, to refer to the Star referral, will be stricken from the record.
Abby Lowell, the chief counsel for the committee's Democrats, then presented his analysis of the Star report.
The independent counsel can take the same conduct by the president and with all the laws that exists on the books, call them one offense, 10 offenses, or 100 offenses. That is what prosecutors do. But no matter how many different grounds were sent by the independent counsel, and no matter how many majority counsel may further divide them up or rename them to be in order to pile on additional charges, they fit into three distinct claims. First, that the president lied under oath about the nature of a sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky. Second, that he committed obstruction when he sought others to help him conceal that inappropriate relationship. And third, that he abused the office of the presidency by taking steps to hide that relationship. So now, no matter how majority staff may hope to strengthen their recommendation by finding new offenses to tag on, one basic allegation, that is, that the president was engaged in an improper relationship which he did not want disclosed, is the core charge that Mr. Starr and the majority staff suggest triggers this constitutional crisis. As to the allegations that the president lied under oath, whether you call them lying or perjury or false statements or whatever, half the alleged grounds in the independent counsel's referral, and now seven of the grounds renamed by the majority staff, are that the president lied about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. It is not the actual lie about the relationship that rises to an impeachable offense. I suppose the independent counsel agrees that people lie about their improper relationships, but it is the fact that the lie occurred during a civil lawsuit or before the independent counsel's own grand jury that, according to the charges, constitutes the offense. Majority staff's approach, taking up where Ken Starr left off, would have the committee continue to delve into even more details concerning the physical relationship between the president and Ms. Lewinsky, so that I suppose the committee could determine who was telling the truth about who touched who where and when. However, this unseemly process does not have to occur. The better approach would be to take the independent counsel at his charge. If it was the fact that the president lied at his Paula Jones deposition that creates the possibly impeachable offense, then the inquiry required would be to determine the importance or impact of that statement in that specific case. And this is what the evidence shows. These were misstatements about a consensual relationship made during a case alleging non-consensual harassment. When Judge Weber Wright of Arkansas ruled on January 29th that the evidence about Ms. Lewinsky was, quote, not essential to the core issues of the case, end quote, and when she then ruled on April 1st that no matter what the president did with any other woman, Ms. Jones herself had not proven that she had been harmed by what she alleged, the judge was giving this committee the ability to determine that the president's statements, whether truthful or not, were not of the legal importance suggested by Mr. Starr, let alone the grave constitutional significance to support impeachment. And a prolonged inquiry is not required to see that proper context.
At the end of the day, the committee debated the length and breadth of the impeachment process.
Clerk will call the roll.
The main Democratic proposal to set a standard for impeachment and conclude any inquiry by Thanksgiving was voted down along party lines. Republicans' five-member committee majority was expected to ensure passage of the open-ended inquiry Republicans favor.